That explains why Marty Shupak reacted as violently negative to David Pines as he did. Now, this evening, of course, there was the party for Harris Wofford, and I threw together the usual physics department punch and fixed up the house and cut up cheese and all the crap, and they came in about 8:30, and the party ran along pretty well, and about, I guess it must have been almost exactly 11, or was it midnight? I guess it was closer to a midnight, maybe a quarter of 12. I went over to the Union with Jerry Mauger, and we chatted about the Virginia Drake situation, which is also developing interestingly, but that certainly is a digression. Anyway, I came into the Union, and the first person I saw was David Addison and his wife, and they were about ready to go into the dance, which was going on in the Union. This is Tony Zamora playing. It was heavily black kids at the dance. Tony is black, and apparently it was a regular Illini Union activity of some sort, probably part of New Student Week, I don't know. But anyway, it had been planned. Dan Perino was there, ran into him very briefly. But Addison chatted with me for a moment, and he had just a couple of things to say. He said he'd just gotten back. Apparently he was up in Chicago yesterday taping some kind of a talk program on TV. People call in, you know, and he answers. He said that the way he was feeling right at the moment, he was pretty discouraged about the administration, but he was always pretty discouraged about the Black Students Association, of, you know, basically how little assistance he was getting from what were supposed to be a lot of officers and staff at the BSA. I endeavored to reassure him a little bit about how things looked, but about that time he was called away by his wife, and he really did disappear into the room. Well, I just sat there, figuring that maybe he would come back. It wasn't clear that our conversation was at an end, and I really wanted to convey to him that things were looking up a bit and to try to feel him out. I sat there for quite some time, chatted a bit with the guy who was stamping people's hands and then looking to see, in fact, if the people going back and forth were having their hands stamped. There was a lot of banter between the North End kids, or I will say, between the Negro kids and this guy who's white, who's a checker. They played games like, you must remember me, and he'd say, yeah, as a matter of fact, I know your hat, so I know you've been in there. And it was all in good spirits, but they were taunting him a little bit. I think it could have worn on one after a while. It was just sort of little petty harassments. I think that it was really done more in a spirit of fun. They were laughing over having to show their hand every time they went in and out. In fact, some of them really had a lot of fun by insisting on showing their hands on the way out. Okay. Anyway, this kind of thing was going on. There was also some just gentle chatting with the cops. They seemed not the kids they were. I was watching seemed to be perfectly oblivious to the policemen. They walked by them without feeling too badly about them or anything. Now, what happens next is that a couple of cops come up to the two cops who are sitting next to me and start talking to them quickly, and I didn't really want to push my ear right in, but it was apparent they were talking about some kind of incident. And the fellas sitting next to me shook their head and said, darn. And then at that time, suddenly they got a little message over their little radios, which they have plugged into the ear, and all of them went charging into the ballroom, and they were saying, I shouldn't say ballroom, this is Illini Room B. And they were saying, gee, we got him in here, see. And I could see through the door that there was a certain amount of activity. Now, I felt that it would not be wise for a lot of bystanders to go rushing in to have a look. And so I made a point of sitting where I was and to kind of, you know, by my examples, keep everyone else who was out in the hall sitting where he was. But a small crowd assembled. Apparently the people they were grabbing were right near the door of the ballroom. And apparently, the two of the three students, white students, who were making this complaint had entered from some other door with other policemen and had identified these kids, because I never saw the white kids go in, the ones making the identification. But what was going on in there was that two white kids who had been with a third who had been slugged were identifying the assailant, or assailants, not clear on that, and that was what was going on. Now, a prominent at this point, right away, was a reporter type, with a sheet of paper out and writing on it like mad, and I knew I'd seen him somewhere before. I didn't know who he was. He was asking for names. He came right out and asked me which room this was going on in, and I told him it was Illini Room B, and he was zipping right back in, pushing his way through people, black and white, to get to the center of the action. And he was behaving unbelievably conspicuously. He was more active in many respects than the police, who were nabbing a guy. The police then hustled this guy out with rather remarkable dispatch, and they were followed by a straggle of blacks and by this reporter. Now, the reporter kept dashing through the blacks, not being too careful about who he pushed and shoved, and I kind of have an image of him just running around, skirting people, darting in, trying to get up to where the cops and the people in custody and the people who were making the complaint were. And all this time, I thought, man, this guy is not doing us any good. At this point, I ran into Kenny Allen. He says, geez, I wish you could cool that guy. And I said, yeah, I kind of agree with you. And he says, stick on him, would you? So I did stick on him, and we all then followed this whole melee, whatever you want to call it, to the Illini Union office up there in the front behind the desk. And into the office went the accusers and the accusees and the police, and stopped at the door was Mr. Ed Black. And this turns out who it is, Ed Black. Okay, I kind of wandered around the front because there seemed to be more activity there, and a bunch of kids were just jiving, and I tried to ask a black kid or two what was going on, and they didn't really have much answer for me if they paid any attention. And finally, I was standing next to a guy who was really, really putting it on pretty heavily. And incidentally, I've got to repeat one thing, which has just come to me. As they were closing the door into this office, the black kids who had tailed along were really pushing to get in as well, and the cops had to sort of pull them back. One guy spit directly into the gap between the door, and whether or not he connected with it with an officer of the law, I don't know. But I do know that the police made no attempt to get him or anything of the sort for his spitting, and I would say that was rather severe provocation. I want to make the point now, if I don't make it later, that the police behaved all evening with remarkable restraint, I would say. And in fact, I felt that their tact was of the maximum. Yeah, I was extremely pleased. In any event, Black was left out there. Now, I don't know which of these following two things happened first or second. I don't think it matters, so I'll simply put them in this order. I walked around, as I say, to the front to kind of look in and see what was going on. I couldn't see anything. I found myself in the middle of all black people. The guy next to me says, they can't do that. They can't do that. He says, if they do that, we're going to burn this place down. Look at all this wood, he says, and he pointed to the wall. And I thought, well, he seems to be jiving, so let's see if I can jive with him. And I says, oh, but you can't do that. And then I listened to my voice, and I said, oh, shit, you said the wrong thing, brother. Anyway, you said it in the wrong tone of voice. And he turned to me, and he says, oh, yeah? He says, and just why can't I? And I said, and I started to make the story. I says, well, you know, the guy who runs this place was here when the damn place was put up, and this wall is so sacred to him. I said, well, we can't even put pole boards on. But the point is that he hadn't sorted me out yet, and I was being real dumb. I was running off at the mouth and not coming right to the point, which was that the woodwork is something of a joke with me, as it happens, because I fought to have bulletin boards put up in the union, and I can't disturb their wretched woodwork. And I had a feeling of empathy with this guy, but I realized I wasn't communicating it. And at this point, he just interrupted, and he says, listen here, buddy. He says, you're the wrong color. You just might not be safe here. He says, you would be do well to get out of here. And I said, yeah, you know, you just may be right. And I said, I think I'll go out that way. And instead of going out the door towards the street, I turned around and started to go back. I said, I just shook my head in agreement with him, basically. He stood motionless for a few minutes. And, he wasn't looking terribly close at me. He wasn't really giving me the stare. But on the other hand, he wasn't really dividing his attention too much on anything else. So I basically backed down and walked around the corner. About this time, I ran into Ed Black again, and he was just standing there fuming by the door, and I said, well, what is going on? And he wanted to know why I wanted to know. And I said, well, I'm just kind of sorting it out. And he says, well, who are you working for? And I said, I'm not working for anybody. I'm just sorting it all out. And he said, well, this is my story. I'm on this story. He says, I'm a reporter, and I'm getting it. He says, it's not your story. And I said, well, you're right, man. Like, I'm not filing with anybody. I just want to know what's going on here. And then he went on to tell me what was going on. Said that there had been this assault by three guys on three guys or something of that sort outside the union, and that the one guy had gotten slugged, and that they had traced the people who had done it into the union and had caught them. So I said, well, where are the three people who were assaulted? And he pointed over to, he says, one of them is in there somewhere. He says, his head's really swollen up. He says, and the other two are sitting right over there in that couch. And he pointed at two kids who were sitting over there in a couch. Well, now, something I'm missing here is that somewhere in this, there was an exchange with Ed over coverage of some sort. I guess that's it. He asked me what I was doing, and I must have told him that I was worried about the newspaper coverage, and so I was kind of following around on the thing, and that I was very upset by the Tribune. And he says, "Well, you certainly certainly have nothing to complain about in the Sun Times, do you?" And I said, "No, but that came out reasonably well." And he goes, "Well, I wrote all those." And I said, "But wait a minute, wait just a minute." I said, "Those all bore Bernal Heinecke's name." And he goes, "Well, he gets his name on him because he's the bureau chief down in Springfield." But he said, "Actually, he just came up here for a couple of hours. I did all the spade work. I got it all together for him, and it's basically my story. Just kind of rewrote it a little bit." And I said, now he was being very belligerent at this point. And Kenny Allen, as I say, had already warned me against him. I said, "Kenny, do you hear what the man just said, that he is responsible for everything that went on into the Sun-Times?" Kenny says, "Yeah, I heard it, man, but boy, don't believe it." So we were giving him a slightly hard time. But anyway, somewhere in here, he pointed out the two kids over on a sofa, and I said, "Well, I just think I'll go over and chat with them." And he immediately went up the sky. He says, "You do not chat with them. You don't say a thing to them." And I said, "Well, now, what are you talking about, man? Like, you can't tell me I can't talk to somebody. I can talk to anybody I want." And he goes, "This is my story." He says, you haven't got any professional ethics at all." We had some exchange over whether or not I wrote, and I said that I don't know why I got in this argument with him. I can't quite remember how it developed, but he was making some pretty smart-ass remarks about how I wouldn't know anything about, oh, yes, it was, I haven't. Bernal Heinecke, he says, is the bureau chief, and something like that. He says, "And I'm a such-and-so," and he identified himself as Stringer or something, you know, and he says, "But you wouldn't know anything about that." And I said, "Well, that's kind of a belligerent statement. Why do you have to be so mean?" He said, "How do you know I don't know anything about that?" He says, "Because you're not a newspaper man." And I said, "Well, I've published as many lines as you have, I bet." He says, "Go on." And then he went on and identified himself as this great, wonderful journalist. Well, anyhow, he really got mad when I suggested that I was going to go over and talk to his two witnesses, and he went screaming over there first. He said, "Well, I'm going to talk to him." And he went screaming over there first. And I said, "Well, I'm going to listen." He says, "Don't you come near here." He says, "You stay away." And I said, "Man, like, I can stay wherever I want to be." And I went over and said to the two guys, and he was right in front of the two guys, and he says, I guess that was at the end. He started asking them, he got ready to ask them questions. And I said, "Excuse me, gentlemen, do you mind if I kind of listen in on this thing?" And he told me to get away. And I said, "I didn't think it would." And he said, "Well, he just didn't operate like this, with people hanging over his shoulder." And I said to the kids who he was about to interview that I hope they wouldn't mind if I listened in on this, but the press coverage of all of the incidents in the union this week had been uneven, and that I was trying to keep a ride on it, and I would just observe. I assured them that I would not interfere with the man's questions, and if it was all right with them, I would listen in. And he said, "Well, you can't listen in." And I said, "I really think it's these gentlemen's decision as to whether I do or not." And they basically nodded yes. And he says, and then he stood up very angrily and says, "Well, I've got a story." He says, "You're interfering with my work." He said, "What's your name?" And he says, "Eisenman." He writes that down. He said, "What's your first name?" And I said, "David, D-A-V-I-D. Well, anyway, he then sat down and he said to the first guy, "Look," he says, "I understand that you may feel that you're not, it's not safe for you to give me any information, but," and I said, "Ed, I cannot believe that you asked that question." I said, how much can you prejudice the man's remark? That is perfectly remarkable that you just said what you said." And then I said, "Oops, excuse me. I was not supposed to be interfering with this man's interview." I said, "Go right ahead." But he really hit the fan at this point. He said to the guy, "Well, now," he says, were you assaulted?" And the guy said, "No." And he goes, "Well, didn't you just say to me? Didn't you just say to me 5 minutes ago that you were afraid to give even your name because your reprisals might come out against you?" And the guy said, "No, I didn't say that." And he goes, "Well, isn't your name?" And then he came out with a name, and the guy said, no, that's not my name." And he said, "Didn't I just talk to you out there?" And the guy said, no, you didn't." And he said, "Well, are you a student here at the university?" He said, no, I'm not." He says, well, are you from the Air Force Base?" And the guy said, "No." And at this point, he threw his hands up in disgust and walked away, and both kids at this point kind of spontaneously said to him, "Look, we just came in the union here and sat down. We have nothing to do with this story at all. You know, like we've been entertained, but we're not involved." And Ed really blew his cool at this point. He really got mad. Well, he got up and left, and they asked me what this had all been about, and I explained to them that Ed was rather overreacting to the whole thing, and that apparently he had mistaken them for the two guys who had given him his story. Well, as soon as I stood up from chatting with them for a moment, I tell them what it had all been about, because it must have been very confusing, I must say. The two of us competing for their attention, and they had really no reason why we should. But anyway, I got up only to see Ed talking to another guy right over, right, you know, 10, 15 feet away from me. So I got right over there, and this fellow was volunteering to Ed a change in his statement. And apparently this is one of the three. And he was saying that the guy was carrying a brick, he says, but I'm not sure that that was what my friend was hit with. And Ed says, you mean you don't know whether he was hit with a brick or not? And the guy says, yes, that's right. I don't know whether or not the brick actually was used in the assault. And so, and this was steaming Ed up. But then this guy started heading back. The guy had been giving the words to Steve, headed back toward the union office. And I followed him, and I stopped him and tried to say, excuse me, but I'm trying to put together simply an independent account of everything that happens here this week along this line. I said, could you give me a little idea of just what did happen out there? And he goes, well, yeah, we were walking along, he says, and this black guy pushed one of us, and at this point, somebody pulled on him and dragged him back into the room, basically. I don't know if it was the police, whether they were getting ready to move out or what was going on, but this is all I got from him. So I can say that I have an eyewitness who told me that the provocation was being shoved by a black man, and I have the rest of it as pieced together earlier from Ed's distorted views. Ed continued to be obnoxious. Kenny Allen had an anxious moment in there, incidentally, somewhere, where some guy told him, get out of the way, white honky, and Kenny gave him a sort of a sharp answer, but also moved. It was not a taunting answer, but it was he stood up for himself. I thought he handled it well. Now then, the next thing that happened was they paraded out, the police and a couple of guys who were going to go to jail, and apparently some of the white witnesses or something. In fact, I think it must have been all three white witnesses, because I remember a line of three white guys, but these fellows all marched out in a phalanx of cops, probably about, I don't know, six cops maybe. And as they went, in the meantime, there was a group of very, very noisy Negroes. One of them is the one, I think, who had just hollered at Kenny, and perhaps the same one who hollered at me, told me to get out of there. This guy really hollered after this group and says, you can't do that. The use of the term motherfucker was used an awful lot. Cops were motherfuckers. The language was pretty wild. But this kind of thing got hollered after, and it seemed to me to be the usual rhetoric. I didn't see anybody doing anything violent. It was the kind of agitated thing that I expect in the Italian community in Bradford, Pennsylvania. But anyway, as the white kids were walking down the steps in the midst of these police, this fellow hollered one thing like, boy, you testify or something like that. And he says, and I'm going to be out after you, and that's a threat. And you can take me in now. He kept saying over and over again, you can take me in now. I'm going to vault right over that desk right there and get my buddy out. No, wait a minute, that comes later, excuse me. The vault over the desk bit was about the camera. A photographer turned his camera into the guy at the union. But this is getting ahead of my story. Anyway, on the way out, something fairly provocative was hollered by one of the black kids, and one of the white kids turned around and answered and said, oh, geez, if I could only reconstruct the words. But it was something to the effect of, you keep hollering like that, buddy, and you're going to be sorry because, you know, things are going to happen to you. So it was something of that type. Well, the black guy just really jumped up on that. He goes, you come up here and say that to me. He says, I dare you to say that to my face. And he came run right out after the fellow. And he just raved. He just stood at the edge of the automobile that they were being put into, hollered into it. He made attempts to grab through the windows, which were then rolled up. He really danced around. He ran out in front of the car and said, you can't run me over. I'm going to hold you right here. He says, you're going to take that back. You're going to stand out here and say that to my face, that kind of stuff. And at this point, a photographer showed up and started taking photographs, and immediately the other kids in the crowd got very, very exercised about the photographer. One of them was a fairly chubby kid, and he said to the photographer, you give me that film, and was really demanding the film and the camera, and grabs were made at the camera, and the police just sort of interposed themselves between the kids and the guy with the camera. And this thing really escalated quite a bit. The same guy who had been arguing into the car gave up on that and started hollering at the photographer. And there really was some pushing and shoving. And again, this is where I think the police were remarkable. It was the kind of thing that I would not consider menacing. I didn't see anybody ready to pull a knife, slug anybody. It was pushing and shoving. It was just, I would say, an animated protest, if I might. I mean, that was the mood of it. I think technically, probably, someone would be able to say that there had been an assault and that there had been threats and all. Well, I guess a threat is an assault. They might even have been able to claim battery, you know, I mean, the guy got shoved. But the point is that the mood of the whole thing, in context was simply that of a strong protest, like, why do you want our photographs? There was extreme suspicion, you see, that something was going to be... Well, the guy who was dancing around the car and hollering the things was obviously wanting to get arrested to cause an incident. He was doing everything he could to provoke that kind of retaliation. He kept saying, you know, take me in now, brother, because I'm going to bust the law. Now, on the other hand, you see, the other kids are a little more level-headed, and they saw a photographer taking his picture, and they figure maybe later charges will be pressed. I don't know. I'm double-guessing the kids' thinking. But anyway, what ensued was that this little row over the photographer continued as the photographer went into the union, and in the lobby... this one kid really went berserk and insisted that he was going to leap right over the counter and snatch the camera from inside. And at this point, three of his buddies just got a hold of him and held him pretty tight. And he just kept raving. And the one guy kept hollering back and saying, you finished? You know, you wait for me to say something? And that kind of thing. And finally, he was finished. It took a long time, though. And this other guy said, look, just cool it. He says, just cool it. And this guy says, you can't hold me, you can't hold me. And it's entirely implausible. He pointed at the stamp on his hand, you see, which entitled him to get back into the dance. And he says, I'm allowed to go in. And his buddies released him on the basis of this unbelievable argument. And he went, at this point, he was chastened. I mean, they had waited for him to calm down. But he went charging off toward the dance. Well, I talked to Kenny Allen lately, and I apparently he didn't do anything more. But really... The kids around him did a good job of subduing him and really get him back calm. I thought the cops stood by and let the other kids subdue him, and I think they did a magnificent job. I also want to point out, incidentally, that when there was the activity around the police car out in front, just slightly before what I've just described, there were a bunch of Negro girls, and I suspect they were in our project, who were standing by the white pillars kind of watching it all, and it was taking place in the first parking lot on the right as you face the union, first parking space. And one of the girls said, say, you know, I think we really better get out of here. And I turned to them and I said, yes, as a matter of fact, if I were you, I would beat it, frankly. I mean, this may not turn anything, but I think it would be very well if the bystanders just not hang around. And they took off like mad. I think there are a lot of little lessons in here for us. I must say the one thing I haven't put in here is that all of the black kids I'm talking about, the jiving in the hall, the guys who were arrested, and I'm not sure about the guys who were arrested, I'm not sure that I got that close of you, but all the jiving and the guy I've been describing in some detail were all definitely teenagers. They were certainly high school age, no older. This now is the incident is in as much detail as I can really recall it. I think I've done a fairly good job on it. And I filled you in on, I filled in on the interaction between Pines and Shupak. I think I'm pretty up to date with everything I know. I would like to have more details about this group that Cornum called together and the mystical experience of having he who has been assaulted and he who did the assaulting get together and chat. I need to know more about that. Cornum tonight said to me at the party at our house for Wofford that he was thinking that maybe what we should do is have the students have their own 500 program, and he's talking about a house and black kids and white kids and so on. And I mentioned to him that that's similar to A, to one thing Mel's been talking about, and B, the one thing we haven't thought about in this program is what do we do with the kids who flunk out. And we maybe ought to have an office that deals with them, that tries to find them jobs, see how much they gain, what other experiences could be of use to them, and not just drop them back to wherever they came from and sort of write them off. So this was the interaction with Cornum tonight. I think I also just had a long chat with Bruce outside before I came in here, and it's worth reporting some of that. Bruce is very concerned about the program itself. He says that Shelley said to him before the bust at the height of the evening that it would be a couple weeks before he'd be able to talk to Bruce about the tutoring. That this had been the week to do that. That the registration week they were was, you know, kind of written off, but the next week was the thing for that. Now it looked as if that week would be written off. So now this is Bruce told me this after we'd had a little discussion about my status. I made it clear that I was resigning because I felt that it would be embarrassing to Daniel Alpert and perhaps constricting to me for me to continue to have my current position. Bruce was against that, figured that I really didn't have to go that far. But he got to talking and he said, really, maybe Shelley needs you in the worst way because there is this tutoring program to be set up. He says, you could do it single-handedly. You know more people than Shelley does. So This tells me two things. One, Bruce is beginning to think very positively and forwardly. I think he has realized, I think he's come down a long ways from where he was the other night. And secondly, it is maybe plausible that I could work for Shelley. I've been nervous about Millett in the whole thing, but fuck Millett, you know, that's the point here, to make a horrible pun. Maybe I can be a dollar a year man, which I think makes it plausible that I am independent agent, but still makes me sufficiently official so that I can deal with these for these kids for Shelley. I don't know. I'm still toying with this idea, but I want to report Bruce's mentality, my mentality, and everything I know about the day, and I think I have done that pretty effectively. So it's now 4:15 Sunday morning. There's going to be a thing, breakfast for Harris Wofford here at 9:30, and I think I'll ring off and try to get some sleep. This has all been recorded at the Center for Advanced Study. These are some quick vignettes which I'm putting on tape this afternoon. This is now Sunday afternoon. It is roughly 4:30 p.m., and we have just had the New Year convocation attended by what I would call a record crowd for such things. On the program were Harris Wofford, and Mr. Wofford's speech is now in my hands. I'm here at the center, and I'm about to Xerox it on our machine. The speech is what I consider a small masterpiece. I couldn't help thinking during the program that it's Wofford is a deus ex machina. Fantastic, walking right in, saying precisely the right thing. The president appears to be upset. Because it is a little bit hard in Mayor Daley and the law and order issue. However, that's something I'll get in here. Now, I would also like to record other little things which seem to be important. Mrs. Peldison remarked to me before I went into the dinner at noon, which I crashed, for university officials and students and who are officially involved with this convocation and from Dr. Wofford. She remarked that the chancellor never dreamed that the word sent the police in reluctantly would cause the reaction it did. He rather expected the liberals and the bleeding hearts to be very upset if he wouldn't put that in. He never dreamed that the law and order people were as strong as they appear to have been. This is her remark. My vignettes from the convocation, which I viewed from the second row, were Millett sitting next to Morrison. Do I imagine that Millett and I exchange a hard stare? I'm not sure. The Gaudiamus Igitur is being sung, and my eyes fill with tears. Bruce and Mary Alexander of Volunteer Illini Projects are on the stage not wearing academic gowns. Mary's in a very nice, pretty red dress, not even terribly formal. The idea is that Schrader took his gown off, and gowns are not going back on until we are full academic partners in the university. This is what Bruce tells me. It's not a protest. He doesn't intend to issue any statements, but that's what is in his mind. Cornum is not here. There's an empty seat in the front row. Cornum is supposed to be introducing the Mr. Wofford, but he's not there. We know that his speech is being worked on by Rossman and himself since last night when the party was running on at our house. It turns out later that, in fact, he did arrive, in fact, was in the place at 2 o'clock, but just through a mix-up, didn't realize that he was to march out with the rest of the people, and that Dan Perino tried, apparently put a message up onto the stage to do something about getting him there, but to no avail. Bruce says that he turned to Dean Millett and said, "There's Cornum right there," and that Dean Millett simply looked up in the air and looked around, made no effort to do anything about getting him on the stage. President Henry gave Stodgy what I think he probably felt was a very sensitive and meaningful speech. Basically, it was empty. The contrast with Wofford's speech, I was willing to give Henry credit, as a matter of fact, for having given a competent speech. But it certainly, although it maybe meant something to me, certainly didn't mean anything to our freshmen. Wofford, however, well, his speech will be part of the record somewhere else. I think that pretty well takes care of this afternoon, and I'll now sign off.